Good afternoon and welcome to the United States Institute of Peace. My name is Raymond Gilpin. I direct the Economies and Conflict Center here at the Institute, and we are very proud to host this session. I see many familiar faces in the audience, so I will not bore you with all the details about the Institute. We have a lot of material outside that speaks to who we are, what we do, how we do it, and with whom we do it across the globe. But very briefly, the Institute is an independent, nonpartisan institution created and funded by the U.S. Congress. And since 1984, we've been doing a lot of stellar work in the areas of conflict management and peace promotion across the conflict spectrum in as many conflict areas as you can think of. Today we want to take a look at business and the link between business, conflict management, and conflict and peace promotion. We have a very ambitious agenda, so I'm going to ask you to bear with us. But we do have a very stellar panel. We have the event is going to be organized in two sessions. The first session will be a panel that would look at concepts and frameworks related to business and conflict and peace promotion. And after that, we'd have a series of case studies that illustrate how these conflicts are applied across the world, how challenges are overcome, and what smart questions practitioners and scholars should be asking. And so I hope that on or around 4:30, we would have covered a lot of ground and we'll be able to leave and enjoy the warmth of Washington, D.C. on this scorching Monday. before I take my seat, let me briefly introduce and turn it over to Professor Tim Fort, who is Executive Director of the Institute for Corporate Responsibility at George Washington University Business School. Tim is one of the thought leaders in the Peace Through Commerce initiative. He recently is, I think this year's theme is Peace Through Tourism. He'll be mentioning it a bit. We are particularly honored and grateful to have Tim part of this event, moderating the first panel, not just because of his intellectual leadership, but the breadth of practical knowledge he brings to the subject. He'll tell you a bit about his Peace Through Commerce initiative, and because we don't really have that much time, I'd refer you to the bios of all the panelists and speakers which we have on the table outside. And at this moment, turn you over to Professor Tim Fort, who would moderate the first session. Join me in welcoming him.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you, and good afternoon. It's good to see all of you today in a nice, cool environment in here as opposed to outside. I started to work in the topic of what I call peace through commerce about 10 years ago, and I have to say that it makes me feel really good to see the number of people, thoughtful people here at this conference this afternoon, this workshop this afternoon. During that 10-year period, I've co-authored or co-edited three special journal issues, academic journal issues, written three books, and hosted six conferences on the topic. And while the conferences are great, we've had wonderful participants in those conferences that would last 2 days, sometimes 3 days. I think that this is one of those events this afternoon that pound for pound, we have the highest wattage, if I can mix the metaphors here, highest wattage that we have available. We have some excellent panelists here that I think will put into context some of the issues of business and peace as effectively in 2.5 hours as any four or five people can on this planet. And so I'm very pleased to be able to co-moderate this. The plan for the first session today is I want to introduce the speakers individually before each one. I'll just give a mention, but as Ray indicated, we're going to make use of the biographies, the written biographies, rather than have me drone on reading all the wonderful accomplishments that each of them have done. And then I will have just a couple of comments about the work that we have done in the academic field of peace through commerce to summarize the first session, and then hopefully have plenty of time for lots of question and answer. So the first person that I'd like to introduce is one of those people who were there not only with me at the beginning, but preceded me at the beginning of some of this academic work, because when I was starting to look to my own research 10 years ago to figure out what I would say about the topic, there were two main resources that I looked at. One was Jane Nelson from the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum, her manual, Business for Peace, and then Virginia was Hoffler was finishing her work with the Carnegie Institute of International Peace, a public role for the private sector. She's an associate professor at the University of Maryland. She has spoken at two or three of my conferences, and I think that she is one of the very best people that you can have to introduce this topic and some of the challenges and opportunities that revolve around it. Virginia?
Steve and I agree that we would sit here instead of standing up at the podium. If you can't hear me, let me know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I figured. I lectured to 150 people in a classroom, so I can actually project my voice. First, I want to thank Raymond and Tim for organizing. Where'd Raymond go? There he is. For organizing this event and inviting me to speak at it, and of course for Tim for such a nice introduction. Although I'm a little conflicted about the pound for pound phrase. I also want to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace itself, which actually started me down this path of research. I was finishing up work on corporate social responsibility when Pamela All here at the U.S. Institute of Peace asked me to write a chapter on corporations and conflict prevention for a volume she was editing. And that eventually launched me into a larger project, also partially funded by the U.S. Institute of Peace. So much thanks there. And also congratulations to the Institute for the recent groundbreaking for what we hope will be a fabulous new headquarters in the near future, although we don't know how near that future will be. And I'd like to thank all of you for showing up on a wiltingly hot and humid day. I hesitated to say yes to coming to this myself. My role here is in part to lay a sort of background and framework for you, and to do that I'm going to go through some of the emergence of attention to business and conflict and peace over the last decade or so. There are sort of two strands of analysis out there in scholarship. One is peace through commerce, which is represented by Tim Fort, and comes, I think, primarily out of the business community and business scholarship studies. There's another strand, which is more about business and conflict, a little more negative, coming primarily from activists, think tanks, and increasingly political scientists and policymakers. This is sort of where I come from, a more global perspective on the emergence of this agenda and its institutionalization over time. Sort of flagging or putting before you a cautionary note in counterpoint to the peace and commerce agenda, which tends to promote the idea of commerce and markets as a positive development, while the peace and conflict or conflict prevention agenda really tries to say it has to be within certain boundaries, within certain contexts, frameworks, and rules. So I hesitate to say I'm the negative voice on the panel today, but actually I kind of am. The analysis of links between peace and commerce is founded upon long-standing philosophical ideas about those linkages between economics, interdependence, and peace. For instance, in Immanuel Kant, it has a long history. But in recent years, that more philosophical approach has been wedded to real empirical analysis, trying to drill down into the exact relationship. There's a debate over which leads to which. Does peace lead to more commerce, or does commerce lead to more peace? But the evidence overall, while not settling that debate, really does indicate a positive link in general at a high level of abstraction. But there is also a mass of evidence pointing to the negative effects of commerce and repeated instances of practices by particular industries and specific companies that have contributed to a range of ills: violent repression, civil war, human rights abuses, corruption, and criminality. For instance, in the past decade, there's been extensive research on the so-called natural resource curse, in which the exploitation of resource wealth paradoxically leads to the underdevelopment of the economy and the undermining of governing institutions. We also have the identification over time of specific commodities, for instance, that finance conflict, or analysis of the ways in which financial institutions actually facilitate repressive regimes, transactions by rebels, criminals, and corrupt officials. And there are numerous instances in which specific companies have been accused of complicity in violence and repression by authoritarian regimes, or accused of directly contributing themselves to the conditions that foster rebellion and violence. So the conclusion we might draw here is that while commerce in general might be associated with peace, particular types of commerce and particular companies are not associated with peace. And therefore, what is needed is some way to establish a framework to change the practices and behaviors associated with them. And this is where we get what I call the business and conflict prevention agenda. To promote specific practices and mechanisms to preserve the benefits of commerce while reining in or mitigating the negative effects. Now, as Tim already noted, this particular agenda is now a decade old. This is literally, if I had to date when you could say globally attention turned in this direction, it would be 1998, when a number of reports came out, a number of initiatives were launched, and clearly this became more a part of the global policymaking agenda. There were specific conditions that facilitated the emergence of this agenda, I would argue. First, the end of the Cold War was an obvious one, but more importantly, immediately after the Cold War, the increase in the number of civil conflicts and the level of violence within countries across the world, across the developing world, and the concomitant search for solutions to that. This was in part due to the perception that traditional tools, such as traditional diplomacy and negotiation, or more negative things like sanctions, had failed. And we have, for example, long-running civil wars in Africa that seem to have no end. At the same time, we have the ascendance of policies that promoted a neoliberal market agenda, promoted and facilitated globalization, the extension of markets, and particularly foreign investors into less developed areas with weaker governing institutions, along with a policy preference in a lot of leading states for private sector solutions to problems that had formerly been viewed as specifically the province of government action. And the third factor I would point to is the rise of transnational activism, but more importantly, not just general activism at the transnational level, but specifically the kind that targets corporations as the main beneficiaries of globalization, calling for increased corporate accountability and increasingly making corporate reputation an important asset of companies and a lever to change their behavior. Essentially, the activists were changing the cost of doing business as usual. Now, 10 years later, today, thinking about this talk today, I thought, have these conditions changed? Well, we know that conflict around the world and the death toll from violence has, in fact, decreased over time, as reported by the University of Maryland, my home institution. However, the number of states engaged in conflict has actually ticked upward in recent years, and governing institutions in many countries still remain weak, and these are the states most likely to fall back into conflict. And, of course, we have the massive enterprise of rebuilding Afghanistan and Iraq, which, of course, dominates policy attention. When it comes to globalization, we do see some challenges to continuing globalization and the liberalization of markets, the failure of the Doha round of the WTO to conclude successfully, a socialist challenge from Hugo Chavez and his followers, perhaps the emergence of China as a new challenge to the traditional, to the dominant ideology of the day, with its state-owned companies investing increasingly in the developing world. And perhaps, finally, the potential for a global economic recession looming over it all. And it's not clear where that will lead, except perhaps to more conflict. Certainly, when it comes to transnational activism, it has not gone away, although there has been some backlash against the activist organizations, a questioning of their accountability and their claim to represent the people for whom they claim to speak. So some of the conditions facilitating the emergence of this agenda have changed and yet remain the same in their fundamental characteristics. Key change I see, and the one that I'm most interested in talking about today, is the institutionalization of the corporate conflict prevention agenda. In other words, the degree to which this particular agenda has actually been integrated into organizations and mechanisms specifically in my analysis at the global level, although some at the national and local level too. The particular ways in which they get institutionalized tend to be related to some very specific characteristics of, that I can point to. For instance, if there's a clearly defined problem or opportunity or obvious solution in which business clearly has a role, it is more likely to become institutionalized in some ways. Typically, they are pushed forward by urgency, crisis. In other words, the perception that if you leave this untended, it will just get worse. And usually, and I would say necessarily, there is some external push. In other words, activist organizations, media attention, these outside voices that really push for action on what is perceived to be an urgent crisis with a very specific definition of the problem and potential solution. So what kinds of institutionalization do we see in the past decade? Well, first I'd start with the UN Global Compact. It set the agenda in the 1990s, an agenda that has really in many ways remained the same. It was very prescient, I think. One of the first things the Global Compact did, and this is an initiative by the United Nations in the Office of the Secretary General, at that time Kofi Annan, they launched a series of business in zones of conflict policy dialogues that laid out specific conflict prevention initiatives for business, promoting practices such as increased transparency, attention to human rights practices, management of the revenues that can fund rebellion and violence, the adoption of more conflict impact assessments by business and conflict-sensitive business practices, and an attention to fighting against corruption. All of these have remained part of the business and conflict prevention agenda, and the question now is how you implement them, and the UN Global Compact is, in fact, attempting to promote these on the ground around the world. One other thing at the UN level I would point to is the appointment of John Ruggie as the special representative for the United Nations on human rights and on business and human rights. And they've done an extensive amount of research on what is going on with business and human rights issues, and just recently have put out a significant policy report to guide both business and the wider global community on how to deal with the intersection between business and human rights. More significantly, there are a number of collective initiatives that were launched only in the last decade, many of which you may be familiar with, or some of which. For instance, the Kimberley process for the certification of diamonds as being not from conflict regions. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, pressing governments to be more transparent about their resources, and the Publish What You Pay Coalition that puts pressure on corporations to be equally transparent, if not more so. We have an attempt by the World Bank to manage revenue in establishing the Chad-Cameroon natural gas pipeline project. We have a collective attempt to establish voluntary principles on human rights and security. These are some of the highlights of new initiatives specifically directed at the intersection between corporations, conflict prevention, and human rights. All of them are partnerships among industry, non-state actors, and either governments or international organizations or both, all in different degrees and in differing ways, establish best practices for industries operating in conflict zones or areas that are unstable or poorly governed. Further institutionalization of this agenda, however, goes beyond the collective initiatives. What's really interesting is the degree to which it's been integrated into established international NGOs, either ones that focus specifically on this issue, such as Global Witness and International Alert, or ones that never had this before, such as Amnesty International, which now has a whole business and human rights sort of program or department. More NGOs are balancing, trying to balance their critique of industry with their willingness to work with them in partnerships for conflict prevention. And certainly the NGOs have been quite successful in establishing corporate social responsibility as a common societal expectation in a way that it was that was not true a decade ago. The diplomatic and development agencies of many governments now incorporate partnerships with business and promote a corporate conflict prevention agenda in different ways. Places like the U.S., the U.K., and Germany all have, and Canada, have all merged conflict prevention and the business role with their development and post-conflict reconstruction programs to the point where it is now taken for granted, to the point where if you ask them, well, why didn't you do this a decade ago, they don't even understand the question. They assume that this was always true. I actually asked someone this, and they were very befuddled by my questioning the shift to attention towards business in conflict prevention, post-conflict reconstruction, and development activities. There's now a lot more action at the local or national level, and the other panelists today will get into some of the nitty-gritty of that. What I sort of end up with in looking, surveying the last decade is, so how durable is this? How really institutionalized is this institutionalization of the corporate conflict prevention agenda? Well, if you look at it, in fact, there have been relatively few global initiatives or even national ones. It's still pretty fragmentary and ad hoc. Both public and private sector actors remain, although willing to talk about this, the level of action has not been what we would desire. With the increase in competition for markets around the world, especially if we have global recession, in fact, the incentives for business may actually to participate in these activities may actually decline. Existing initiatives have struggled to establish themselves, and more importantly, to expand their membership. Here I would point to, for instance, the Voluntary Principles on Human Rights and Business, which has still remains a fairly small group. And I would also point to the fact that in terms of the reputational incentives for business, they may actually want to have a smaller club of participants in things like the Kimberley process in order to enhance the reputation of those who participate while leading to more competitive pressures on those who don't. Particular initiatives have been critiqued along a number of dimensions for their weakness, commonly attributed to their generally voluntary nature. And there's been a big debate upon their actual effectiveness and impact. The results of this activity have been uneven and in some cases unconvincing, with observers critical of both the collective and individual efforts of business, partly because I would argue we do not have an accepted definition of how exactly to evaluate success. What would a successful corporate conflict prevention initiative look like? Would it, in fact, lead to peace? Or is it something short of peace that we are looking for? In order to get the kind of success that we need in corporate conflict prevention initiatives, we do need to change the definition of self-interest of all the participants, promote further partnerships between different interests, and established a higher level of enforceability of the initiatives that have been launched. In a report that I co-authored for the UN Global Compact a year or two ago, we pointed out a number of areas in which governments and, in other words, I should say public actors as opposed to the private sector, can facilitate and enhance the probability that the private sector will contribute to corporate conflict prevention. Governments can assist weakly governed states to develop stronger institutions at home. A lot of this boils down to, a lot of the problems we see with business in conflict zones boils down to the inability of governments to govern. We need to strengthen and harmonize interstate efforts to govern cross-border economic transactions, perhaps through more certification initiatives like the Kimberley process. And we need to develop policies and practices that support private sector efforts to reduce the negative impacts of their business operations. Overall, the corporate conflict prevention agenda, while identifying a lot of the negative relationships between commerce and peace, or commerce and conflict more specifically, it also points towards a variety of different means by which we can paint a slightly more hopeful picture and try to change the incentives for business to operate in ways that mitigate their impact on conflict dynamics and promote the development of peaceful institutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Virginia. Our second panelist today is Steve Heiderman from the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's the Vice President for Grants and Fellowship Program and Special Advisor to the Muslim World Initiative. Steve?
Thank you very much. Let me also thank Raymond for inviting me to be part of this panel, and Tim for moderating it, and all of you for coming out. It's a noble effort. Can you hear me? Is it possible to hear me? A lot of my work has been less on the relationship between business and conflict, or business and peace per se, than on the relationship between institutions, institutional arrangements, and economic development more broadly. And my role on the panel this afternoon, if I understand my guidance from Raymond correctly, is to draw on some of the insights from that work and to try to apply them to this specific problem. I'm afraid to say that Virginia is not going to be the only pessimistic voice about some of the possibilities for the use of business in mitigating conflict or in achieving more peaceful outcomes in conflict-ridden contexts. I will also have some somewhat pessimistic observations to pass along based on my work, but I will try to temper those toward the end with perhaps some slightly more optimistic observations about the possibilities for using processes of institutional reform to create conditions in which business can play a mitigating effect on conflict. But let me begin by making just a couple of very general kinds of observations. And the first is to reinforce a point that Virginia started out with, and that is that this notion that doing business, that engaging in commerce, can over time serve as a force that mitigates conflict, both by making conflict too expensive, too costly, for actors who have decided that it makes sense to focus their energy on doing business instead, but also by transforming the norms and values that shape how people interact, has a long and honorable provenance. It dates back to at least the period of the religious wars in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. The very famous political economist Albert Hirschman wrote a book called The Passions and the Interests, in which he talked about how the use of commerce, the use of economic exchange among parties that had previously been at war with one another over deep-seated ideological differences, did have a kind of dampening and disciplining effect on social violence as an organizing principle of societies and of intersocietal interaction. So this idea has been around for a very long time. It has an honorable history, but also, second general observation, and one that I think is probably much more in keeping with what the topic of our what our interest is in this topic today, is the recognition, I think, that this idea about the disciplining effects of commerce really has to be understood, I think, as one of the most important and durable ideas shaping U.S. foreign and economic policy throughout the entire post-war period, perhaps to an extent that hasn't really been fully appreciated in trying to wrestle with the problems in a contemporary context. We can see its influence in the Marshall Plan and programs for the economic reconstruction of Japan and Germany. It's evident very clearly in post-war modernization theories like those of Seymour Martin Lipset or Rostow or others that viewed economic development as a precondition for the emergence of democracy, to the extent that that very relationship became the basis in 1979 for an article that I'm sure you've all read and remember as clearly as if it were yesterday, by Jean Kirkpatrick, called Dictatorships and Double Standards, when she railed against the policies of the Carter administration because of the extent to which they seemed to embrace that notion of economic development as a precondition for the emergence of democracies. We see it again in the democracy promotion policies of the United States in the 1980s, especially in the part of the world that I work on most, the Arab world, where, with the exception, I think, of a very brief period in 2003 to 2005, for reasons we all understand, U.S. policy has tended to favor economic reform over political reform, has embraced a policy that I call markets now, democracy later, in the very clear assumption that markets would bring with them the kind of spillover benefits and, in particular, jobs that would have the effect of dampening the appeal of extremist movements for youth, especially young men, around the Arab world by giving them a clear material stake in avoiding participation in some of those movements. And we can see it most recently, and this is where I think it intersects with what we're doing here this afternoon, entering again into programs of agencies like USAID, where the Office of Poverty Reduction has been working for the past couple of years to try to find intellectual frameworks in a wide variety of locations that would be, help them to test this notion that business and the deepening of commerce can have an effect in helping to address problems of conflict and persistent poverty around the world. And they have paid particular attention in this search for theoretical frameworks to the field of new institutional economics, especially the work of Douglas North on institutions and economic development, and they have somewhat come to the conclusion that this work holds out lessons about institutional design, institutional reform that can be applied to these settings of conflict and fragile states, and where a key piece of this work has focused in particular on how to create institutional frameworks, especially institutions governing property rights, the security of property rights, that will promote commerce, strengthen markets, and create conditions in which business and investment can thrive in the expectation that well-designed, well-functioning markets will have the kind of dampening effects on conflict that have long been attributed to them. And it's this most recent effort by parts of AID, but also others, to think about markets as providing the kind of institutional frameworks that can transform cultures of conflict that I want to focus on in my comments, and I want to do it by playing devil's advocate a little bit. This is where the pessimistic outlook comes into play again, and by raising some questions about the underlying assumption that markets and all of the institutions that support them can really serve as effective antidotes to conflict. And what I want to do first, and I think perhaps most important, is simply to urge caution about the tendency. It's a tendency that I see as quite widespread in this field, and I hesitate to say it, but I see it reflected a little bit in the framework that defined our panel this afternoon, to define state failure and the persistence of conflict and poverty as a result of conditions in which institutions are absent or in which institutions are even perhaps defined as weak. Douglas North, who's been one of the touchstone authors contributing to the field of new institutional economics, Nobel Prize-winning economic historian, has a book, Understanding the Process of Economic Change, and in the book he calls institutions the incentive structure of economies, the incentive structure of economies. But he acknowledges that there's lots of instances in which those incentives are insufficient to produce the kinds of changes that we've been talking about this afternoon, transforming conditions of conflict into conditions of peaceful exchange and well-functioning markets, or that institutions themselves, in the classic sense that North defines them, which is as rules of the game, are themselves the source of the public bads that we're trying to transform or overcome. And these institutions, it turns out, often provide very, very powerful incentives and sustain patterns of behavior that contribute to state failure and contribute to the persistence of conditions of conflict. And I know that this is the panel in which we provide general frameworks, but let me give you just a couple of examples of what I have in mind by that. Some very potted, very quick examples that are notable more for their superficiality than for anything else. But let me proceed anyway. First, one from the Middle East and one from Africa. And I want to talk about the Lebanese Civil War. a conflict that lasted from 1975 to 1990. During the war, the Lebanese state collapsed. A network of sectarian militias grew up to provide protection for individual sectarian communities. And these militias very quickly expanded their role from the provision of security for specific ethnic neighborhoods, or sectarian neighborhoods, sectarian communities, and became very highly organized instruments of predation that operated under very explicit sets of rules and became, in effect, or provided the frameworks, in effect, for incredibly well-consolidated systems of what we would call now economic governance in Lebanon that were extraordinarily wide-ranging. Militias engaged in the taxation of the communities that they were assuming the role of protecting. They managed the equivalent of cross-border trade among the militias with which they were fighting. It's really an extraordinary phenomenon, the extent to which these armed actors who were killing one another at one moment would be negotiating very complex trade agreements with one another at a different moment. They operated large-scale transnational smuggling networks for the movement of drugs, weapons, money, people. They engineered the emergence of an entire illegal market for the import and distribution of fuel oil all across Lebanon's territory. And one of the interesting elements of this network is the extent to which it relied on the provision of state licenses for the import of oil to give themselves the veneer of legitimacy for maintaining this criminal distribution network within Lebanon. And what we find in general, as a broad point overall, is that criminality and conflict and markets became so deeply intertwined among these militias and within Lebanon's political economy during the Civil War that undoing this political economy of militias was, in fact, one of the leading obstacles to finding a solution to the conflict. And in fact, I think we can safely say that it isn't even clear today whether the end of the war in 1990-91 with the Taif Accords brokered by the Saudis really brought about the dismantling of these militia economies that the war created. And I think that uncertainty applies in particular to those parts of Lebanon that remain under the control of Hezbollah. So that's one example of the way in which conflict is really organized around deeply embedded, highly rule-governed systems of economic governance. They're not contexts in which institutions are absent or weak. Let me shift to Africa for a moment in an even more potted sense, because here we have a whole continent that I'm going to summarize in grossly simplistic ways. If we take seriously the recent work of a very well-known political economist of Africa, Robert Bates, who just came out with a book this year, earlier in 2008, called When Things Fall Apart, he underscores the extent to which Africa's economic and political collapse in the late 20th century, including the outbreak of some of the most severe conflicts in the region, Liberia, Congo, Rwanda, and so on, can be traced in large measure to a region-wide decline in public revenues, a decline produced by a wide range of political shocks, but also economic shocks that Africa experienced, the resulting erosion of state institutions and formal systems of economic governance as state elites became increasingly predatory, and where the kind of economic institutions that took hold in Africa, the kind of markets that became dominant in Africa, were anchored in the use of public authority for private gain, on one hand, and the privatization of economic regulation, the privatization of governance by citizens on the other, such that, and these are Bates's words from the book, people now dwell in a world wherein the government has turned into a warlord and where they themselves have picked up arms. And the lesson, in my view, of these examples for anyone who wants to use markets or expects commerce to mitigate the conditions of conflict is, as I noted earlier, to recognize that conditions of economic stagnation and social conflict are not the result of an absence of institutions or even necessarily the weakness of institutions, but in fact, perhaps just the opposite. It's much more likely that state failure and economic failure are themselves the product of deeply embedded institutions of economic governance, including well-defined, well-established rules that govern behavior like the ones I've been discussing, corruption, predation, rent-seeking, and so on. Important to recognize as well that these institutions are often highly efficient in delivering economic and political benefits to select members of society, even if they do so in ways that create insecurity and vulnerability, poverty, conflict for the majority of the population. And the implication, I think, for purposes of this panel is the importance of recognizing this core point, that failed states and failed economies are often richly endowed with institutions that mitigate against efforts to achieve institutional change, and that processes of institutional reform, including efforts to create conditions that will be favorable to business, have to be designed from the outset to contend effectively with the competing incentives that make these densely institutionalized contexts so compelling to those who benefit from them, especially the most powerful actors who have very strong incentives to resist institutional reform and preserve systems of governance that are individually highly lucrative, but that are collectively deeply dysfunctional. And just as a last word, I think trying to change incentives through institutional reform without addressing this challenge, without taking these kinds of problems into account, is simply not likely to produce the sorts of behavioral shifts that can turn markets and commerce into effective instruments for mitigating conflict. Now, the question that I'll pass on in the interest of time, but one that we might want to return to at some point in the Q&A, is how do we do that? Even if we recognize what kind of processes of institutional reform are needed, and even if we recognize that even contexts in which conflicts persist have to be seen as encompassing deeply embedded sets of rules of the game in which certain actors have important stakes, what do we do about it? How do we unmake these situations and create the more productive contexts in which more broadly productive economic institutions can replace those that support and sustain conditions of conflict? And I will leave it at that.
Okay, all right, very good. You know, it's kind of dangerous to be a moderator and get the opportunity to speak. It's like there's no time clock or anything. I control that all on my own, right? Yeah, right.
You get people on both sides.
I know better. I'll just make a couple of remarks here. I think it's sort of interesting with our panel that we have very different sort of backgrounds and perspectives that we're bringing to the topic. Mine is that I'm a business ethicist. I have taught business ethics for about 22 years. The last 3 years at George Washington University, where I hold a professorship in business ethics. Before that, I was at the University of Michigan. And I got into this when I was at the University of Michigan because I've always had a sense of a particular way that businesses should operate. And that's what business ethicists talk about, how businesses should operate. And so to piggyback on some of Virginia's early comments, and Steve's really as well, from an institutional perspective, there's a lot of crappy things businesses can do. And they can make things really lousy and make for a lot more war. I mean, sometimes when we think business and peace or businesses are supposed to support peace, does that mean that we're going to have colonialism or various kinds of exploitation? I mean, this is the proverbial fox in the chicken house kind of a thing. And so, but the way that I got into this was as I was finishing a book with Oxford University Press on business ethics. And just for my own avocational interest, I've always been interested in peace studies. And I noted that some of the things that I was describing as the ways to organize corporate structures to encourage ethical business behavior through what I call mediating institutions analysis also tended to correspond with some attributes of relatively nonviolent societies as determined by anthropological research. And I thought, that's an interesting connection. I wonder if there is a reason to be ethical in business, because by doing so, you might mitigate the likelihood of violence. So it was a very normative way that I looked at it, of a particular kind of business that might do good things, as opposed to other kinds of businesses that might make the situation worse. And so that's how I embarked on the studies. And I, with a co-author, Cindy Scapani, and I, we wrote a book and a few articles leading up to the book called The Role of Business in Fostering Peaceful Societies. And we identified four things, four contributions that businesses can make. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Four things that we think that businesses can do that would contribute to peace. One is doing what businesses do best, which is provide economic development so that you create jobs, you reduce poverty. That's particularly true if you can create jobs outside of the extractive industries, because the more you can differentiate the kind of economy that the countries work in, the more it seems to lead away from the kinds of behavior that leads to conflict. Paul Collier did that study with the World Bank that shows one of the best predictors of a civil war is if the main export product is an undifferentiated economy or commodity, because then the whole game is how do you fight over that particular geographical space that holds the resource. So the more you can differentiate the economy, the more you lead away from that kind of a dynamic. Second thing was, and I'm summarizing a lot here so that we can get to Q&A, but second thing is to the extent to which corporations follow what we call external evaluation of their action. This is rule of law kinds of stuff. Neither Cindy or I are empirical scholars. We're both lawyers, and I also have a PhD in theology. We couldn't do a regression analysis to save our children's soul. But we did one correlative analysis, showed a perfect correlation between corruption and violence. That is, using Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index and the Cosimo Index by the Heidelberg Institute of Peace Research, we showed that exactly those countries that are the most corrupt are also the ones that are most likely to resolve disputes by violence, and it just sort of falls into place after that. And so it's correlative. There could be a third underlying cause that explains both of them, but it seems suggestive that if you've got a corrupt society, that the way you maintain the corruption is through using violence, and you can imagine the buildup of pressures of frustration if you're in that kind of economy on a regular kind of a basis. So to the extent that corporations can foster rule of law of avoiding corruption, strong anti-bribery policies, for instance, within their organization, or fostering or trying to promote government efforts to support property rights, contract rights, dispute resolution techniques, those all, again, seem to lead away from areas that are denominated by violence. The third is what we call building corporate community with two respects. One is the external dimension, which is corporate social responsibility, as generally discussed, you know, being culturally sensitive, environmentally friendly, being respectful of your local cultures, populations, ethnic groups, customs, religious festivals, things like that, things that are pretty well known. But the other one, which we think is a little bit more interested, and again, as Virginia indicated, the peace through commerce stuff primarily comes out of business schools. And so we operate with a particular frame of reference. And within business schools, you will find pretty strong consensus, as you will in those other two, by the way, in terms of business ethicists, of one of the better ways to profitably run companies isn't through very authoritarian management structures, but through structures that enhance the voice of the people who are working throughout the organization, if for no other reason that you have to speak up in order to make sure you have quality processes. And so there is a dimension of self-governance and voice, not corporate democracy. I'm not talking about employee democracy, but simply if you want a good quality product, you need to have everybody, give everybody the opportunity to speak up if they see a product defect. And so there is a dimension of voice, which is associated with democracy, and we would love to get some of our empirical colleagues, and some of them are trying now, to chase down whether there are spillover effects of corporation using these state-of-the-art management strategies, whether there are spillover effects in the societies in which they operate, of whether that would spur more kind of democratic processes in the society itself. And then the fourth is a version of track two diplomacy, whether corporations could foster a way for conflicting parties to talk. Virginia mentioned International Alert. They released about a 500-page document here, what, about a year and a half ago, that had all kinds of studies that show the ways in which corporations could play a role in that. A lot of the work that the UN has done with Virginia has been focusing on exactly how corporations can play a role in this, things to look out for, things to not look out for. So those four things were the specific things that we said that corporations can do in order to make some sort of a contribution to reduction of violence. Now notice those four things aren't particularly controversial. You would get a lot of consensus of a lot of business people and a heck of a lot of business ethicists to say that providing economic development, a return to your shareholders, being sensitive to rule of law kinds of issues, and being responsive to your stakeholders in the community are pretty garden variety accepted ways of doing business. What we argued is that if companies pursue these more mindfully, they will enhance their ethical behavior, which creates a virtuous cycle that would then more likely lead to reduction of violence. So that was the argument that we made in the first book. And then the second one that came out last spring, last fall, I basically said that these kinds of recommendations don't simply come out of nowhere. That if you look into the anthropological literature, if you look into primatology, if you look into hunter-gatherer literature, if you even look into contemporary political thought, in terms of soft power, sharp power, sticky power, that you can see that these dimensions of economics, of politics, and of ideas are things that are stitched into our very bones and go very back deep into the way that primates, chimpanzees, in Franz de Waal's analysis of how chimpanzees resolve conflict. It's a balancing of these three kinds of ways, of these kinds of approaches. And so my argument in the second Cambridge book was basically that these are very much rooted within us. They don't come out from nowhere. They are not idealistic. They are things that we have within our very bones that we can access. Have they been done yet to date? Not much. But then 10 years ago, you wouldn't have seen a gathering like this either. And so I'm the more optimistic one, or the most optimistic one of the group, although sometimes I feel like I'm Sisyphus pushing his rock up the hill, you know. But I'm happy to push the rock up the hill. I mean, that's okay. Camus said that Sisyphus should be happy, and I'm happy just pushing the rock up the hill, whether I ever gets there or not. And so, well, maybe not happy. That would be a rosy interpretation of Camus. But at the same time, I think that we're seeing people who are focusing on this from government, from business, from NGOs that simply didn't exist 10 years ago. And I actually think that there are opportunities and self-interested reasons of why corporations might want to focus on this in the future. One final thing, and not bad, about 7 minutes, that's not too bad. One final thing is I want to give an advertisement that if you're interested in this topic, that I'm going to be hosting a conference. USIP is one of our partners, collaborators in it, for 3 days, November 15th, 16th, and 17th. I'm sorry, 13th, 14th, and 15th, over at GW. On peace through commerce, opportunities for the new administration. We're trying to situate this so that hopefully the election is settled by then. You never know. But hopefully we figured out who the next president's going to be. But also probably before an awful lot of appointments have been made. And so we're hoping to sort of capture an opportunity to try to put this on the agenda of the next administration, to use this as something that we can think about in whoever is elected, I think that this is something that can fit into the agenda of both parties. Let me stop. Let's open this up to question and answer. So anyone who has a question, let's go ahead and fire away. We have a microphone over here. Is that our only mic? Okay. So if you have a question, just go ahead and stick up your hand, or we'll get it over here. Or if you can come up here and pose your question to any of these folks, I'll chime in if necessary. But these two, I think, are the more interesting ones for today.
Lucia Worthington, University of Maryland, University College. I teach business, and I'm interested. I'm thinking of two books that are fairly popular. One I have just read, and it's not popular yet. It's called Bananas, about the United Fruit Company. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, which I use in my strategic management class, is called The World is Flat. And they have different points of view. What I hear you saying, I hear you talking about multinational corporations a great deal. Now, when you look at Bananas, they really started the social responsibility movement in the 1970s. It was really just a public relations strategy. But what I'm wondering, are you considering a grassroots movement that is internal? Economic development internal to the countries rather than multinational corporations, foreign direct investments.
Are you speaking to me?
Yes.
First, I'd actually recommend a different book, Litvin's book, which I now forget the title of. I'm terrible at this thing, and I even used it in class this spring, which actually goes historically from the British East India Company up through the United Fruit Company and beyond, on issues of a sort of corporate expansion globally and corporate social responsibility, and I think it gives a really good overview of that. So
just a recommendation for your reading list. My focus is on MNCs because I like to focus on MNCs. This is not to say that there is not a lot happening at the, on the ground. And in fact, in going around and talking to people, what's very interesting is the degree to which, you know, although there's a lot of attention in international relations, which is the field I come from, on global sort of transnational activism, a lot of it is linked down to local levels, and the local activism against very specific companies or projects in specific places. There's a lot going on there. You can see that particularly with the extractive industries, such as, you know, mines in Peru. You know, there's a lot of pushback against the expansion of extractive industry activities and investments in a lot of countries. So although my focus tends to be global because of my background and interests, that's not to say there isn't an awful lot happening on the ground. And in fact, the book by International Alert that Tim referred to actually looks at a lot of that dynamic between local NGOs and local companies and looks at it really at a different level than I do.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, there is, of course, a wide-scale, large and growing grassroots effort to create kind of micro-foundations for commerce in a wide range of developing world settings. It's called microfinance. And the growing reliance on those kinds of mechanisms as tools that offer possibilities for people operating on a very small scale, very much at the grassroots level, to create strong, well-functioning markets that not only generate resources that can help elevate households out of poverty, but that can mitigate some of the economic tensions that are often a source of conflict at the grassroots level, seems to be really making a difference. So it isn't as if this is all happening at a level of MNCs and then driving downward. There are corollary efforts, I think, that originate at the grassroots level and are working their way outward in a much more kind of horizontal strategy of diffusion.
I would just add a couple things. There's good news, bad news on both the small businesses and the MNCs. With small businesses, they're free to do a lot more than what MNCs are in a lot of ways because you've got a small group of shareholders, and if they decide that they want to do something other than profitability, they can do it. And so they have a lot more freedom. That's the good news. The bad news is they also operate underneath the radar enough so that they can get away with just about everything they want to. And so there's both a lot of freedom to do something and to avoid getting caught. With multinationals, the good news are things like this, where you can take pictures of all the bad things that are doing, and they have to be worried about reputational impact that has. And so that makes them accountable to public opinion, but they are also even more accountable to liquid markets with a lot of shareholders, which are evaluating actions according to how much did peace really make for our business in this quarter, which is a tough argument to make. And so I think that there's positive and negatives with both of those.
Yeah. I have a question. We're talking about business.
Do you want him over here for the recording?
Yes. Do we have someone else here?
Oh, I see. We got one here. Okay. All right.
My name is Faribors Frank Fouladi. I represent a company called Procurement USA, Inc. We are in Montgomery County, Maryland. I believe that food, shelter, healthcare, and education is human rights. It has to be developed in a free enterprise way. So what we have proposed is in four areas, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Palestine, and Liberia, to look for 800 meter by 100 meter land and create a mini Montgomery County, Maryland, in a free enterprise way, so the surrounding areas, they see how a good government works, how the free enterprise works, and keep run it in a, like the way it is in Jebel Ali in Dubai, in such a way that will be like free trade zone, so local government cannot get involved, but people who are in local area, they can come and shop, do business. Will be free trade, commerce, free commerce will be happening. I was wondering that, by the way, I'm a GW graduate also. I was wondering that what's your opinion? Would something like this will contribute to peace through commerce? Because the businesses can come in, do business. They can also live in this 800 meter by 800 meter. We've gone, we are using, building homes that we are selling, building the homes by sending them through Port of Baltimore. So expats can buy the homes and other companies can join. I'm also an associate with Home Depot. Hopefully we can build their homes there in culturally sensitive. So I was wondering, get your scholar opinion on that, all three of you.
I was going to say there's political, there's institutional, and there's peace through commerce in all this one. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first reaction to that is that it's a noble goal, but the idea of mini Montgomery counties around the world strikes me as, I worry about the politics of it. I worry about the degree to which it would be accepted by the community that you're trying to go into. I'm worried about the degree to which it would look like an imposition. I'm not sure how it would play into the dynamics of local conflicts and social divisions. It would have to be done very, very carefully, is my impression.
I would add a similar note of caution, I think, although I think it's a laudatory effort without any question. And that has to do with the extent to which importing models for the organization of business or of markets or of systems of economic exchange that may not connect to and be integrated within local norms within the kind of local institutional frameworks that have governed economic exchange within Afghanistan, to the extent these remain kind of islands that seem to express a set of experiences that may feel fairly remote from those that the Afghan people who have the opportunity to witness what you're doing experience in their own everyday lives. I think unless there were real attention to bridging those divides, real attention to a process of education on both sides about where the opportunities existed for marrying two different sets of institutional arrangements for the organization of markets and commerce, the likelihood that those that were being imported into Afghanistan from the outside would really take hold and be seen by local communities as viable is probably lower than you might ideally like to see. And so some attention to that process of integration and to understanding what Montgomery County might have to learn from Afghanistan strikes me as just as important a piece of the puzzle.
Of course, it has to be culturally sensitive.
Right.
I understand.
Yeah.
It looks like we have a pretty good line up here, so why don't...
Hi, my name is Jay Brandis. I'm with the U.S. Department of Commerce. Very interesting comments. Is there a relationship, or has there been any analysis done on the impact of business, local business, in a fragile or failing state, or from the multinationals in political reform? We've talked about the impact on business and the economics. But what I'm concerned about is, has there been any analysis that with a pro-business environment, locally and internationally, that has an impact directly or indirectly on political reform?
When you say political reform, what do you mean?
Well, let's go from authoritarian rule or dictatorship. You know, when you're opening up to a more pro-business or a new administration, a new government, is business going to have a positive impact on political reform? Is there going to be pushback? I don't think I've read an article that talks anything about the relationship between business and the politics in a given country.
A couple of years ago, if I matter, I worked on a project through the European University Institute in Florence called Networks of Privilege in the Middle East, the Politics of Economic Reform Revisited. And it was really about the role of privileged economic actors in processes of both economic and political reform. And I think one of the general lessons, and it's supported by the work of people like Joel Hellman, who's an economist who spent time at the World Bank, wrote a widely read article called Winners Take All, is that you tend to find, first, very mixed. I mean, it's hard to talk about business communities in monolithic terms. Mm-hmm. And that you find a wide range of reactions to processes of political reform on the part of business communities. But that often what we see is that powerful business actors tend to promote processes of both economic and political liberalization up to the point at which they're in a position to capture the benefits of reform, at which point their support for reform diminishes. And so it's really a kind of mixed bag. The role of business in processes of political reform, at least in the parts of the world in which I've done most work, has really been very much a mixed bag, and that preserving the kind of political economies in which they benefit from privileged access to key economic decision makers within the state, in which they benefit from a lack of transparency in public contracting operations, in which they benefit from privileged access to sources of capital and to access to international partners, all of these things are seen as not only desirable but very much worth fighting to preserve. And so while you may see, actually it's kind of interesting, contexts in which limited, selective processes of economic reform actually do begin to generate wide-ranging benefits, benefits that actually extend beyond narrow, privileged business communities, the support of business elites for a broad, comprehensive process of either political or economic reform is often fairly limited.
I think Steve has answered that.
Thank you. Gordon Johnson, I'm Center for Privatization, retired. But I had an email from a friend in an African country, an oil-rich country, who said he had been talking with a resource energy company who was looking for some new ideas on what they could do. And they're frustrated with the government dealing with the government agencies. And I'm sure they're, you know, the standard rules of transparency and these generalities. None of you really have gotten down to some specifics. You've stated the problems very well, that the rich people in control like it the way it is. People who have power don't willingly give it up. Professor Hoffman talked about we need new incentives for business. Well, what kind of new incentives do you have in mind that would change what business does? There are plenty of incentives there now if there were a way to do it easily. It's the obstacles to doing these things. I mean, here's a company that's interested trying to do something, but they've got reasonable management practices, the kind of thing you're talking about of create jobs and the delegate authority to people in the field and so on. But how do you make a difference in the power structures that are running things the way they are if you are an outsider? What can you do? Is there anything? I haven't heard very much so far.
Yeah.
Part of that is because I ran out of time. and I could direct you to the book Enabling Economies of Peace, the report by the UN Global Compact, which I had a hand in, which has a huge laundry list of things we could imagine doing. First, I take issue with you saying that these are outsiders, because once they're in, they're developing oil, for instance. They're inside the system to some degree, and the question is, what role do they play, and what incentives do they have to promote political reform and to change the system?
How?
Well, in one of the big ways, and I gave a list of very quickly of some of the things the Global Compact is promoting that have become sort of standard features of the corporate conflict prevention agenda. One of the biggest ones is transparency, i.e., if the company publishes its revenues, if the company lets the entire society know how much money the government is getting, and how much oil is being taken out of the country. The idea is that if you have an effective civil society, which is a big if, I should note, or if you're a company that actually is supporting the development of a broader civil society awareness and organization, that the society will bring pressure to bear on the government. And so it's an indirect mechanism, because no one is looking for these companies to overthrow the government. I don't think there's any legitimacy to that. So there has to be these more indirect mechanisms. The Chad Cameroon gas pipeline project, in which the World Bank and a consortium of oil companies establish a wider system of revenue management, where a lot of the money that would normally go to the government instead goes to a fund for development. Again, it's not directly addressing the things you're talking about, but it's an indirect mechanism with problems, which we could go into, but it is one of the things that the corporate conflict agenda tries to get at is new ways of doing business that will mitigate some of the problems you're identifying.
Just add something very quickly to that. There is no silver bullet for these kinds of problems, and the strategies are going to be heavily context sensitive. And if you're talking about countries where the structure of state revenue is anchored heavily in the sale of natural resources, where income flows directly to the state and gives policymakers an extraordinary degree of autonomy, I think the options for intervention become far lower. But in other kinds of contexts, there are instruments that have been used successfully to try to reform local practices of economic governance. One is in the domain of labor, where, for instance, in the case of Jordan, which has created an area where called QIZs, qualified industrial zones, a formal complaint was lodged by an American-based labor regulation organization that was taken very, very seriously by the government of Jordan, and that led to a wide-ranging process of labor market regulation reform that the Jordanians, in fact, sent their minister of labor over to Washington to present to a variety of interested groups, because they recognized that that kind of oversight mattered a great deal in the reputation of the Jordanian companies that were trying to find export markets abroad for the products produced in these QIZs. Another instrument are our free trade agreements, FTAs, that have been used, or agreements like the multi-fiber agreement, which is now nearing the end of its life, in which the U.S. government has paid explicit attention to the quality of economic governance, quality of business practices as elements, not dominant elements, but important elements of the negotiation of those agreements. And then there's grassroots advocacy work. And when you think about what's happened in the area of sweatshops and the reform of working conditions in a number of countries that promote contracting arrangements between local factories and multinational suppliers, especially of consumer goods, I think we can see that there are reasons to think that these instruments can, under some kinds of circumstances, be effective in producing change.
I'd like to add two things, and then Raymond, you can tell me how we're doing on time. Two responses to that. One, I'll tell in the form of a story. When I taught my first business ethics class 20 years ago at Loyola University before I went to Michigan, it was an evening program where students worked full-time and got reimbursed for their course. And I had a student come up to me before one of my classes and said, "Is this a good course?" I said, yeah, I think it's a good, no, is this a really good course? And I said, "Well, yeah, it's one of the better rated courses. I think, no, I want to know, Professor Ford, is this a terrific course?" I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Why are you asking?" "It's the only course my employer won't reimburse me for." That was a business ethics course 20 years ago, corporate responsibility course. Now, I mean, I always said that I had to do a song and dance for the first half of the course just to convince students that it might be a course worth their taking. Now students are just falling all over themselves to take corporate responsibility course. And the biggest challenge that I have now is that they're not going to solve world hunger in the first 3 months of their job. I mean, it has become mainstream. The sea change in 20 years has been absolutely unbelievable. This is a new thing, this business and conflict and peace. I mean, it's an old thing, but it's a new thing too. And so I don't know exactly what some of the answers are, but if I see the progression of how ideas take hold, particularly in this topic area and given some of the forces that are at work, I would expect that you're going to see a lot more concrete things in 10 years now, just like you saw the progression of what has happened with corporate responsibility. Some of it's fluff, but some of it's real, too. The other thing I would argue, and one of the reasons why I think that it will hold, is that there have been two big drivers for corporate responsibility. One, at least within in the West, and the U.S. in particular. One is the legal mechanisms like Sarbanes-Oxley, and more importantly, the federal sentencing guidelines that require certain procedures in order to stay out of trouble, in brief. The other is the corporate social responsibility, which is because of the cell phone cameras that you want to project something that's good. There's a lot of psychological empirical studies that if you want to develop cultures of ethics, you have to ask people to do more than try to stay out of trouble. You have to ask them to try to aim for something that's good as well. The federal sentencing guidelines were amended 3.5 years ago so that corporations in this country are now supposed to not only develop compliance programs, but to develop, quote, organizational cultures leading to ethics and compliance. They are having legally to face the ethics and culture issue. How are they going to do that? They're going to have to plan good as well as staying out of trouble. This is a way to merge those things together, which strategically within businesses have not been done in the past. And so I think that there is a legal enforcement mechanism of developing cultures that's going to have to access doing good. And this is one of those things. Environmental sustainability is another big one that I think is going to be a driver that people are going to have to start figuring out exactly how to do that. Boards of directors specifically are going to have to figure out how to do that. And that means, I think, that there are going to be incentives to come up with those concrete things that we don't anticipate now but will be standard operating procedure in 10 years. Raymond, are we done?
Yeah, I think we are. Well, join me in thanking the first panel for their... And as they leave and the next panel comes up, we'll start with DVD. Bear with me, it's only 10 minutes, but very interesting stuff that the State Department's new Economic Empowerment in Strategic Regions initiative is looking at. And I'll ask while we have a bit of a transition, I'll ask Catherine to put it up. And because we've had a number of questions about what's happening on the ground, how do we translate a lot of these good ideas into action? And let's take a look at what some people are doing. We have the first presentation by video from the EESR at the State Department. And then we'll hear from Kim Becher, who is the Knowledge Management Officer at the Center for International Private Enterprise. And Kim Smarzik, who is Managing Director at Emerging Markets Limited. And they would give you some on-the-ground perspective and put a lot of discussions we've already had in context. So, okay, yeah. I think our technology is a little, okay.
Hello. I'm very sorry I couldn't be here with you today in person. However, I would like to provide a brief overview of our new Economic Empowerment in Strategic Regions Initiative, or EESR. The basic mission of EESR is sustainable private sector job creation in regions where lack of economic opportunity helps fuel conflict and support for radical and extremist elements. This initiative provides business development, advocacy, and matchmaking for individual entrepreneurs in the target regions. It's not a foreign assistance or development program. We don't provide loans, grants, or equity capital directly. Our role is to link up local capitalists with those who do, for example, USAID, OPIC, and the IFC. We don't have program funds or legislation, but that gives us the freedom to focus on connecting local business opportunities with partners and resources across the public-private spectrum. Now, just a few words on the theory behind this. ESR has been described by some as a laudable effort by the U.S. government to try and address the root causes of extremism. Though we always appreciate encouragement, that's not our rationale for doing this. The relationship between economics and conflict is a complex one and often misunderstood. Virtually all poor people don't become terrorists, while the vast majority of terrorist and extremist leaders tend to come from well-educated and middle or upper-class backgrounds. Their motivations and grievances vary, and job creation is neither a panacea for conflict resolution nor an antidote to extremism. So you might ask, if conflict isn't about economics, how can job creation make a positive difference? Well, in some cases, it might not. To take an example, in Gaza, economics is a clear casualty of conflict rooted in historical, territorial, and religious disputes. In Mindanao, in the southern Philippines, a central grievance of the Moro National Liberation Front is poverty. But in the same region, the Abu Sayyaf group is inspired by Salafist ideology. Their vision of Islamist rule cares little about the redress of economic disparities. To take another example, in Northern Ireland, economics was an important element of that conflict and has proven to be critical in solidifying the peace. These examples suggest a basic conclusion. While economic growth is not a substitute for political resolution, as a general rule, jobs and economic opportunity tend to mitigate conflict and dilute sympathy and support for extremism. In addition to material benefits, jobs enhance individual dignity and foster hope that tomorrow may actually be better than yesterday. Most importantly, there are gritty and resourceful capitalists even in the most difficult conflict areas. EESR's mission is to find and help them. Now I'd like to tell you a little bit about EESR's origins and the model that we've developed. This all began with a very simple question. How can we get U.S. companies to invest or engage in conflict regions where the need for job creation is greatest? Because of the extraordinary risks and obstacles, few U.S. businesses generally invest in these areas on their own. More won't do so absent sweeping legal and financial guarantees that the U.S. government simply can't give. Therefore, we decided to reformulate the question. By shifting our attention to local entrepreneurs, we've placed the emphasis where it belongs, on helping real capitalists in these regions scale up their businesses, regardless of whether that help comes from private, public, for-profit, or charitable sources. The first step in designing our model was defining the gap. Viewing development as a pie chart, we see capitalists at the center, creating wealth and jobs. Outside the circle is a broad array of actors, including the private sector, U.S. government agencies, NGOs, multilaterals, and so on. Each has its own mission, aiming at different pieces of the development pie. Some efforts are coordinated, but most are not. The capitalists in the center benefit from some of the crossfire, and several entities exist to give them grants, microloans, technical assistance, and training. But no one is dedicated exclusively to being their agent and advocate to help them develop and market business ideas with potential partners and resources. EESR seeks to fill that gap, facilitate those connections, and link up these capitalists on the ground with partners and resources from the U.S. and around the world. Now, our strategy for doing this is simple. We identify local capitalists in the target regions, help them develop their ideas, provide marketing and outreach for inputs like loans, risk insurance, or simple charity, and thereby help them expand their business and create jobs. EESR strives to be as agile and informal as possible. Our only test for projects is whether they'll create sustainable private sector jobs. While proposals need not follow a standard format, we do provide suggested guidelines at our website. Now, you'll see the donuts on the right-hand side of the slide. They're there because a few months ago, we were speaking to a U.S. Army civil affairs officer in eastern Afghanistan. And he asked us, what if I know a local entrepreneur in my area of operations? He's helping us, and it's someone we want to support. And he says he wants to start a donut factory, and as his proposal, he draws a box of donuts. What would you do with that? And we said to him, that's more than enough to get an EESR project in the works. Now, that may sound facetious, but identifying local capitalists and sourcing business ideas is half the battle. Making them a reality is the other half, and that's where our initiative comes in. Our process is fairly simple. Proposals are sourced from the field, usually by intermediaries. These can be U.S. and coalition staff in country, both civilian and military, as well as field staff from NGOs and public and international organizations such as the UN and the World Bank. We're also looking to diaspora business communities such as Pakistani and Afghan Americans to help generate proposals through networks in their native countries. Once received, draft proposals are farmed out to teams of volunteer MBA students who help refine and develop them for posting on our website. Now, you may have noticed we say business proposals rather than business plans. That's because EESR projects may not all be traditional for-profit ventures. Some will, but others may be closer to philanthropy or CSR-type opportunities. Since this initiative is a market-based approach, we're quite content to let the marketplace decide what and where the value is in each proposal. Therefore, we've asked the MBA volunteers to help their principals craft proposals that are marketable to the full spectrum of public and private partners. That could mean program managers at the World Bank and USAID, a risk analyst at OPIC, or a business development officer at General Electric or Procter & Gamble. We plan to market proposals in a surgical manner based on each project's unique needs and sectors while reaching the broadest possible audience. Finally, here's an illustrative sampling of our current projects. All are now under review by MBA teams in the U.S., and that aspect of the program has already proven itself. Even before any projects have been posted, some principals have said they never would have come this far without the help they're receiving from the MBA students. So far, we have 12 proposals in hand, many of which came from USAID out in one of the provincial reconstruction teams in Afghanistan. We're encouraged to see proposals like the one at the very bottom, which involves cutting and polishing gemstones. This connection was made by a USDA staffer at a different PRT in eastern Afghanistan. Gemstones have nothing to do with agriculture, and this project has nothing to do with USDA's mission in that country. Even though sourcing EESR projects isn't his day job, this USDA staffer leveraged his presence and his relationships out in the field to find the opportunity and send it our way. This is a good example of how we want to be a force multiplier and help extract more value from the field networks that already exist in these strategic areas. In closing, let me tell you where we are today. EESR is a pilot program that went live just 6 months ago. Before that, we spent months developing our strategy and soliciting feedback from our many interagency partners in the U.S. government and in the private sector. Now, some of them were critical and, frankly, didn't see a need for any new program. But because of the extensive feedback during the design phase, we were able to develop a model that's realistic, that leverages rather than competes with existing U.S. government programs, and most importantly, one that fills a narrow but critical and deep gap in current job creation efforts in these regions. EESR has a large and growing constituency of supporters and advocates within other agencies and among NGOs, the U.S. military, coalition militaries, and the private sector. Many of us have said that EESR is the missing link needed to amplify existing programs and resources in this area. Still, we've yet to answer the most important question of all, which is whether EESR can deliver results. That will take some more time, but we're confident the answer will be yes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and if you have any questions or suggestions, we'd very much like to hear from you. Thank you.
That was a brief presentation about a new initiative at the State Department which aims to provide assistance for businesses at the grassroots level in strategic but conflict-affected regions. To hear a bit more about what's going on in the ground, I'll first of all turn the microphone over to Kim Betcher from the Center for International Private Enterprise. Kim? Okay. Yeah. Jim?
Yes, we have a PowerPoint.
Okay. Could we have the PowerPoint, please? We'll make the...
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank USIP for inviting me. The theme of my presentation is going to be listening to the local private sector in post-conflict environments. We have to listen to the local business needs and voices if we are to plan for sustainable peace and prosperity. Listening is something that we can be mindful of and apply both operationally in the work that we do as international actors, and it's also something to consider in the broader question of building governance of societies for peace and prosperity. I'm going to do three things. I'm going to tell you a little about how the Center for International Private Enterprise works. We call it CIPE for short, and about our experiences in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Balkans, and then a few lessons that you can ponder and take away with you. First slide on the private sector. I'm going to begin here with the final point, given the discussion that we've had so far. This has already come up. The private sector is not a monolith in any country. It is very diverse. There are, in fact, drug dealers, smugglers, gun runners. There are business leaders who are running state-owned enterprises. There are those who are politically connected, privileged cronies. The Marcos example in the Philippines, all the cronies there would be a good one. You have small and medium enterprises. You have businesses that are attempting to compete internationally without government support. You have businesses within the formal mainstream economy and others outside in the informal or parallel economy. So that there's great diversity of business interests, and we always need to keep that in mind in discussing these issues and think about how do we improve governance across sectors and take action that will improve the economy as a whole for the benefit of society, including business. So, why are we talking about the private sector and post-conflict? It's already been mentioned that business does create jobs. In creating jobs, you're enabling survival in the future and giving people hope. Business does have a capacity to cross ethnic and political boundaries. This happens most especially when you have a functioning market economy. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but by a market economy, I mean economy in which there is equal opportunity to compete. It's a very inclusive economy, not just a few privileged business actors. Business sustains civil society in a few ways. Business does participate in civil society by forming business associations, economic think tanks, and other associations, chambers of commerce. In doing so, business can defend freedom of association and create space for other civil society actors. And the resources that are going to fund all the activities of civil society have to come from somewhere, largely from the private sector. Business is an essential source of information for development. And not only does business know a great deal about the economy, economic activities, economic needs, but it provides another perspective on development from the governments or international actors. Now, to thrive, business as a whole requires good governance. Talking specifically about things like property rights, contract law, the opportunity to compete, be it by antitrust action or what have you. Good governance also entails rule of law, transparency in government's actions itself and in business transactions as well. Okay, next slide, please. So CIPE is an affiliate of the United States Chamber of Commerce, which is the world's largest organization representing business. We are also a core institute of the National Endowment for Democracy, founded in 1983. Our niche is to focus on the linkages between market economics and democratic governance. Now, there are a lot of complex relationships here, but I'll simplify it for now by saying that if you don't have values like fairness, accountability, responsibility, and transparency in your markets, you're going to have a hard time realizing those within the realm of public governance and vice versa. couple things I'll point out about markets. When we're talking about markets, we don't just mean a place where exchanges can occur, a bazaar, for example. We're thinking of a much broader system underpinned by rule of law that allows transactions to take place across a much broader scale and over a longer time. So you're building trust in economic transactions and a larger scale of economy that allows for specialization and productivity gains. Now, you don't have a market just because you have private enterprise. Again, in the Philippines, you can have cronies who are private actors but not operating in a market system. And a market is more than laissez-faire. It's more than exchanges. There does have to be a role for government to support the proper functioning of free markets themselves. So our mission is strengthening democracy around the globe through private enterprise and market-oriented reform. Now, why am I talking about democracy in post-conflict environments? We realize that democracy is not attained overnight, and it's hard to realize this goal when you don't have functioning states, the common problem in post-conflict areas. However, even though we're talking about post-conflict, we do think about democracy for a couple of reasons. Now, when you think about democracy, many people will be thinking about elections, public choices, and representation. But if we go to the next slide, it's also crucial in thinking about democracy to talk about governance. Governance is what happens between elections, or even if you don't even have elections, there's going to be a decision-making process in every country, and there's a policy process. So it's very important to look at how you're building the institutions, how you're building the economic policies, thinking long-term, but even in the short-term, you know, issues of transparency and so on do apply. All right. Democracy here applies in a couple of senses. The first is feedback. If you don't get information from communities, local citizens, civil society actors, you can't build institutions. Institutions aren't something that are simply effectively opposed from the outside. They have to be developed from within. And so without a feedback process, you're not going to be addressing the right needs, and you're not going to get local ownership and buy-in. And the other aspect of this is accountability is crucial to democracy, democratic governance. And without accountability, well, whatever your policies are that you're dealing with, you're going to have potential for abuse and neglect of real needs. All right, moving on, please. We've already talked about how we look at institutional development. That's the lens through which we see development and the relationships between democracy and markets. The core of our model is really our partners. We work with local business organizations, business associations and think tanks, and also media groups and others, and really strengthen their ability to engage in advocacy for policy reforms in a democratic, transparent process. Local ownership is, of course, key to this. What we do is we provide technical assistance and financial support in a partnership model. Now, by a partnership model, I mean that, you know, we aren't simply handing out grants to organizations and then telling them that we think this would be a good idea, do this or do that. The ideas for projects come from the partners. The management of the projects comes from the partners. And what we do is offer technical assistance. It could be in helping them through a process of strategic planning or sharing with them examples of international experiences from which they can learn and adapt as they see fit. All right, moving on to Afghanistan. I'm going to start with youth for a couple of reasons. Youth are important because they need opportunities and jobs if they're going to participate in society and not be frustrated. And also, youth are known to be more receptive to new ideas on the whole. We have a program in Afghanistan called Tashabos. It was developed by the United States Chamber of Commerce, originally for General Motors and used in Mexico. We have a locally appropriate version operating in Afghanistan now. It's an entrepreneurship training program. So it's essentially a textbook that describes a hypothetical family business run by a husband and wife in which they take the wife's skill in knitting sweaters and build this up into a manufacturing enterprise. So it's directed at high school students to impart very basic ideas such as what is investment, what is a competitive business, what does it mean to take on risk and manage risk, and so forth. Ideas which are really quite new within that context. We had a pilot program that's been expanded, and from the stories we're getting, it appears that as many as 200 businesses may have been started or improved as a spin-off of this program, although that's not the direct objective. I'll just give you a couple of examples. This gentleman in the lower right was a student in the class. His family did own a couple of eyeglass shops, and he did his own market analysis after studying and decided that the firm should invest in some new equipment to upgrade their ability to make their own glass frames instead of importing pre-made frames with lenses from Pakistan and China. His father said, great idea, gave him some capital, he opened a new business, and here he is today doing work. Another student, his family were formerly refugees in Pakistan. They came back, started a bakery, and they started experimenting with some breads, different sizes and shapes, sesame seeds and so on. And business like tripled or quadrupled. So, you know, students are bringing things home to their families and actually applying this in family business. Okay, let's talk about capacity building and the Afghanistan International Chamber of Commerce is a good case study in capacity building. When SIPE first went to Afghanistan, we did a lot of diagnostic studies, went around to see who the various organizations were. We found very few organizations that were actually active and doing anything independently. There was a government-backed chamber of commerce, but it wasn't very active in defense of business interests. So we worked to support a new federation, building on a couple of significant organizations. And you can see in the bottom left that there was tremendous interest. We had over 2,000 new members sign up within just the first few days of the creation of the new federation here. A really important concern in dealing with associations is the governance of the associations themselves. If they don't have good governance, then they're not able to professionalize. They won't operate beyond the leadership of a single individual, and they won't be responsive to their member interests. And in a post-conflict situation, another important thing about governance is keeping that balance of the different ethnicities and groups that are represented within the national association. So we had a balancing act there, and we helped them with their governance process. They ended up having a board of 60 directors because you had to accommodate, you know, Pashtuns, Tajiks, everybody. And then we said, well, that's not really going to function. So they also had a much smaller board, some power sharing among like the chair, vice chair, the CEO, treasurer. And we helped them spell out a process, you know, where the board had certain rules and oversight and the CEO was actually able to do a job. And then the bottom line is you need to have balance, but you also, merit has to be the overriding factor. And we got there. One thing that did bring everybody together within this diverse federation was the realization that all businesses had to deal with one national government. So they had something in common there. One of the biggest challenges was opposition from the government-backed chamber. We'll often see that the government will have a mandatory association. They try to force all business into it, or tactics to sort of absorb everybody under their umbrella. And we're really big advocates of independent voluntary associations that are forced to compete and offer services to their members, or why should they even exist? All right, next slide, please. One of the main services to members provided has been in the area of investment. You need to have services to have incentives for people to participate in the associations. Advocacy is a big part of everything that we do. We supported a national business agenda process, which is something developed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and that SIPE has used internationally with partners. It's a grassroots movement to gather input about business needs and solutions, and then you funnel it up to the national level. And so this is a consensus-building process, which is a wonderful way of crossing bridges. And then at the end of the process, the private sector can speak with a single voice that with practical solutions that the government can take seriously. A couple of policy outcomes of this process were, one, that airports are being brought into compliance now with international civil aviation standards, something that business wanted, and they streamlined some of the customs procedures and offices. All right, let me, what do you want, Iraq or the Balkans? Pick one. Iraq is the popular one. Okay. Being democratic here. Capacity building in Iraq, really starting from a very low level. The Iraqi Businessmen Union started out with 600 members and branches in, well, one branch. And with SIPE's help, it has built up to 8,000 members and branches in 17 governorates. Here is a good example of bringing the business voice in. Iraq has a fairly new investment law. It was written as a state-of-the-art law without local input, and that never works. It never fits the local conditions. So these Iraqi business people have fought to be included in the process of implementing the law and revising the law, and they actually won private sector representation on a council for investment, and this is being taken down to the provincial level where the branches are working with provincial officials and communities to decide on community investment strategies. Again, something that everybody can agree on is the need for investment. Our program with political party representatives is very innovative. We don't do the kind of political party work that some of the other NED institutes do. We focus specifically on building economic platforms for parties. We found that we did a survey. 70% of small and medium business owners in Iraq said that no party represented any of their interests, and there was no shortage of number of parties. So we brought together private sector representatives and representatives from all major parties represented in the parliament, and found that on economic issues, right across the spectrum, they could agree on the need for growth in markets and investment. And so it was a wonderful way to have some common activity, common action, when unfortunately ethnic and religious issues usually take primacy. All right, let me just sum up with some lessons learned. Again, listen to the local business community. If you're not listening, you're sacrificing essential information and local buy-in and initiative. You have to build the organizational capacity of local actors that speak for various economic interests. And this is true as well, by the way, of other aspects of civil society. I suggest a partnership model in which you allow the partner the freedom to learn by doing and make some of their own mistakes. Let them do things for themselves, but do offer some process and technical assistance to them. Plan for long-term institutional development. Indeed, institutions can have perverse incentives, and it's very tricky to get the right institutions in place. But without institutions, you don't have any basis for long-term growth and sustainability. Promote dialogue on economic policy. It must be open, transparent, inclusive. What is the best for the economy as a whole? And get a wide range of economic actors to participate in that dialogue. And finally, focus your attention on entrepreneurship to build jobs, because we believe that's where the future is. And if you'll permit me, one quick commercial announcement. If you are interested in more case studies of the kind of work we do, I have some samples. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kim. Ken Smazik, Managing Director from Emerging Markets Limited, will share his experience with us now.
How are we all doing? We can all step outside for a little while if you want. All right, thanks. I must say I struggled a little bit, and after hearing a lot of trying to figure out what to say today, but after hearing a lot of all the presentations so far, I think it all fit in and mesh well in terms of, you know, the academic and the practical, and particularly following on from what SIPE has been doing. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about some of the types of things that we've done in sort of post-conflict environments in terms of building business capacity and building business linkages. And I'm going to elaborate on a relatively new activity that we just got started in northern Uganda, where we're actually connecting conflict resolution, looking at conflict resolution on an economic growth platform. And we're using something called a value chain framework. Now, hands up, who's familiar with a value chain framework? Just so I know how much time to spend, not to spend. Okay. I'm going to go through this very quickly because I'm not, you know, there's week-long courses on the framework and stuff like that, so we don't get into too many details. But I think if for those of you who don't, there's a lot more information being developed by USAID. There's two particular ones. It's Online Speakers Corner. This is on the Micro Enterprise website. Online Speakers Corner with Laura Hammond out of University of London, talking about the work that conflict resolution people have been doing and the work that economic growth people have been doing. I'm the economic growth side, so you're crossing the divide. And there's a whole bunch of case studies on the types of things that have done in conflict zones. This one's particularly on an American firm, Donovan Cotton, working in the cotton sector in northern Uganda. So, next slide. Okay, I've got them sequenced in, unfortunately. So we started off, and incidentally, it was 10 years ago, we started off in Bosnia. This was post-Dayton Accord, the peace dividend. There was money being funneled into Bosnia, particularly through some loan programs. But, of course, the capacity of the enterprises to absorb those funds over the course of the conflict had deteriorated. Plus, you had the breakup of a state, which also sort of led to a loss of business activities. And so what we did is we built and started building the capacity of those businesses to be able to utilize those loans and invest in sort of new equipment and new prepare themselves for a new competitive environment, basically. Second one. Then we followed on with a second generation. So the first part of the activity, the first couple of years, was building the capacity of the firms themselves, and then pretty much been destroyed. Okay, the second phase of that same activity then is to build the linkages between the firms. Okay, so they can start thinking as a group, they can start moving in certain directions, they can start taking advantage of competitive signals, et cetera, et cetera. Next one. In Kosovo, we worked on a part of the value chain that's called sort of support sector. There's a huge access to finance problem. Again, a state that had to be completely rebuilt. A lot of small enterprise capacity, micro enterprise capacity. So we transformed a small enterprise loan fund into a commercial bank that took deposits, and that we eventually sold to Raiffeisen Bank from Austria, who's now still operating that bank. It was known at the time of the American Bank of Kosovo. Now it's known as Raiffeisen Bank. In the 2.5 years that we took to sort of build a bank and sell it, we produced about $25 million of loans and about $60 million of deposits. Plus, we also acted as the distributor for public pension funds throughout the country. And we also had to work in both the ethnic Albanian and the ethnic Serb enclaves. Okay, so we had similar services right across the board. And finally, this is the newest activity that we've just taken on. It's northern Uganda, it's Gulu, it's post-conflict. I understand that the peace accord is about ready to fall apart. There was some hostilities, I guess, over the weekend in the Sudanese, sort of southern Sudan part. We don't know how long it's going to last, but basically there's a window of opportunity right now with people coming out of the camps to get them back working and get the economy moving, but also to address the sources of conflict, which are basically just, I think Ray said this the other day in our discussion with Ray, they're just dormant. They're just waiting to sort of come back again, and we have a window of opportunity where we have to move relatively quickly. Throughout these activities, we've practiced what we call a do-no-harm philosophy. We try not to subsidize commercial transactions. Okay, we try to underwrite initial risk and capacity build. Okay, we try not to create a sort of an air of donor dependency. Okay, it's really letting businesses sort of take it from there, and incidentally, when we get to the next couple of slides, showing how business is actually able to contribute to the changing and the enabling environment, which is key for their future and future survival. Next slide. Now, I'm going to tell you to go quickly here, because just go, one, two, three. Okay. In the framework, you're going to hear me talking about end markets. These are key, particularly in the work we're doing anywhere in economic growth, and that is being absolutely sure that there's a market opportunity out there that you can tap into, because the rest of it just falls naturally from there. In northern Uganda, we're finding there's a lot of people sort of talking about the state of affairs and feeling sorry for the people. That's not really the place that can come into the analysis, but it's not the place to sort of look for success. Keep going. Click, 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 click. There's something called vertical linkages between the actors of the value chain. Keep going. Horizontal linkages. In Bosnia, we looked at the horizontal linkages between the producers, the buyers, and the wholesalers in our first sort of activity. Now we're looking at the whole linkages all the way along the value chain. Go ahead. Support markets. You just heard me talk about Kosovo. These are the types of things that we did in Kosovo. The type of thing we did in Kosovo was working on the finance, the access to finance side, which is always a critical part. Again, we didn't subsidize. Interest rates were what they were. They were based on the cost of funds. They were based on the cost of delivery. They were based on making a profit for the bank, which is the reason why we could sell it. Okay, but the initial thing, or the big thing for the enterprise, Kosovar Enterprises, was that they had access to credit. Keep going. Okay, national enabling environment is key for working in the conflict zones, and I'll elaborate on a little bit on that when I get to the Uganda example. But it's looking at the environment in which you're working, and in a conflict, post-conflict environment, that's key. The beautiful part about this framework, and it's ever evolving, okay, is that it's really inclusive. It allows you to get the issues of youth, of internally displaced people. It allows you to get to the issues of governance, of power structure. Where is the power structure in the value chain? Is it somebody dictating the price down? Or if you make price information transparent, open to everybody, the power sort of shifts within the value chain. So there's a lot of things that you can actually do if you know where the constraints lie, and that's where we sort of start off is with an analysis of the constraints. Okay, and why we're doing all this, and particularly in northern Uganda, did anybody see Ruth, or did anybody attend Ruth Campbell's presentation? I think it was last year, about the same time, from HCDI VOC on value change at the USAIP, no? Okay, but Ruth used this, and I stole this diagram from her presentation. It was the easiest way to get it this morning, all right? I couldn't do it myself, so what we're trying to do is go from this, next one. Okay, on the left-hand side is basically relief. Okay, as the relief people come in, their funds start going down. I think Collier's even gone even further to talk about the cyclical nature of money going in and out of the country. And then economic growth picking up on the other side, and somewhere in between we call that the stability point, okay? What we really want to do is get to this, is to start that economic growth activities earlier on. And again, that means doing no harm. It means not creating too much donor dependency. And I'll show you some interventions that you shouldn't be doing in terms of keeping within sort of a do no harm framework. All right? Keep going. Okay. Oops. Back up. What we do, this is an actual example. This is actually what we're doing in Uganda. And you can't, unfortunately, I don't think you can see that. I thought we'd have a bigger screen. So I'm going to try and, on the left-hand side is what we do, the value chain analysis, okay, is when we're looking at the various steps of the value chain. We go through the analysis, the identification of constraints, and we identify prioritized interventions, okay? Then, next one, this is actually a grant program that we put together, okay, and we've labeled out so you, when we find an intervention, okay, we're going to develop a terms of reference, and we put the terms of reference out to the local market, and we have a problem delivering information on avocado prices to smallholders. How do we fix this problem? And you solicit basically input, okay, from local people. And you choose the best model, you fund it, and you let them get to doing their work type thing. On the bottom part here is where we actually start looking at, and in Uganda we have a conflict mitigation expert on the team, and so he's actually looking, when we do the analysis of the value chains, he's looking at assessing the linkages and the causes and consequences of conflict. For instance, in northern Uganda, there's a huge market opportunity in southern Sudan. Okay, but one of the root causes for conflict in Uganda is economic marginalization between the north and the south. So if we build up linkages to southern Sudan, okay, from northern Uganda, we're not doing anything to address the traditional causes of conflict within Uganda. So somehow in the definition of our activities, we're going to have to think of ways of implicating the south or southern power structures so that they're empowered and they feel part of this economic resurgence in northern Uganda. We conduct participatory conflict assessments where everybody's included. We look at the youth issues, we look at the internally displaced people, okay? And then we prioritize those interventions so that we're also looking at stability as well as economic growth, okay? Next one. Stabilization assessments are done by the conflict people. We keep monitoring to make sure that the interventions are addressing the reasons for conflict, and we feed those back in so that one of the things that the value chain framework allows us to do is it allows us to become dynamic. Okay? Dynamic meaning that once you identify the constraints today, and you address three constraints, tomorrow morning there's a whole new generation of constraints that are going to hit you. Okay, when you take the middleman out of a market situation, he becomes a threat. Got to do something with the middleman. Okay, when you give a grant to one community in northern Uganda but not to another, you had better be transparent about why that grant was given to one and not the other, particularly if there's ethnic differences or issues between the two communities. Okay, really have to, the beauty part again of the value chain framework is you can have this conflict lens put on it. Incidentally, we're doing a similar type exercise for a private client who's looking at basically girl power, at looking at integrating adolescent girls and young women into more economic activities. So you can switch the lens. Okay, you just need to know what types of questions to ask. I think you're going to get, do we have copies of this available for the people so that they can, or not?
Yeah,
if not, you can get copies, because yeah. I know you can't read that. It's unfair to sort of keep going. All right, so just how much time do I have?
Five.
Good. Next slide, please. Okay, some examples of do no harm interventions. You know, helping a bank develop a product that's going to meet one of the constraints, okay, but not intervening in the commercial relationship between the borrower and the lender. Internship program for young people to get into an industry, getting them exposed. On all of our projects pretty much worldwide now, we integrate intern programs where we have people, young people coming on, and they learn from economists, they learn from ag specialists, they learn from health specialists, and it gives them a pretty good overview of a situation and an opportunity to get a job further down and or hired by us one shape or the other. Cost sharing some expenses to get lead firms. Again, remember I was always talking about the market opportunity. If you can get a lead firm to start developing some services to help smallholders, you can really have a big impact at the base. And the same thing what we're doing in northern Uganda now, for instance, is we're identifying two or three key lead firms that we'll work with in various sectors, okay, where they can actually help furnish some supplies such as credit and information and quality sort of standards to the smallholders and the farmers that will be supplying them with raw materials. And then behind the scenes sort of promotional events, cost sharing, demonstration plots, exposing smallholders particularly to new ways of growing and the advantages of using fertilizers and proper husbandry techniques and stuff like that. Next slide. Doing harm interventions, and we're seeing some of this in northern Uganda already. You know, direct support. Giving people seeds, giving people direct access to market without really telling them how it's getting there. There's an issue, the Karamoja region, the eastern region of Uganda. If you help one side of the region, that's a region that's no man's land. We're not supposed to go there. But if you help people on one side of that border and not the other, you're going to aggravate the conflict between the two. There's a lot of livestock trade in that part of eastern Uganda, northern Kenya, and it actually, if you follow that whole livestock value chain, the cattle actually end up in the Middle East. It's a whole sort of thing going out to Mombasa. Basically, the idea here is to stay out of the value chain. As an implementer, as a designer of projects, as a supporter of projects, don't get involved in the chain. Believe in local capacity. Let's go to the next slide. And this is sort of the lessons learned. You really have to believe that the local capacity exists, and it does. If it doesn't exist there, you can build it, and you can build it relatively quickly to the levels that will be very appropriate for the situation. Keeping signals very business oriented helps. Keeping it transparent, I think, helps in keeping everybody calm and in reducing conflict. Thinking about sustainability from the outset, how you're going to get out of what you've gotten yourself into. We do that as a matter of course when we design the interventions around the value chain constraints. And really keeping an open mind in terms of continuing to address those helping those people address the future constraints that are coming up in the value chains. And that's it. Under time?
Under time. Cool. Thank you very much,
Thank
Ken.
You.
Okay, we have a few minutes for questions. If you have a question for either panelist or for both of them, I'd encourage you to make your way over to the microphone and ask the question. Please start by identifying yourself and make the question as pointed as you possibly can.
Hi, my name is Anne-Marie Roberts, and I'm a program officer with the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy. This question is directed to Mr. Smarsik. You mentioned very briefly internally displaced persons as one of the considerations when you're sort of analyzing the constraints of what you're going to be doing in country. And I wonder how the role that your peacebuilding activities have concerning internally displaced persons, because it seems like that's one of the sorts of constraints that business promotion and democracy promotion can't really touch very very much. So, could you elaborate a little more on what you do concerning the internally displaced persons?
I can be specific to Northern Uganda. Is that all right? Okay. In Northern Uganda, you know, there was 1.5 million people displaced and put into camps by the Ugandan government, and They're outside of their homeland, not even homeland, outside of their farmlands. And so after basically a generation, about 25 years now, you've had children actually born and grown up in the camp. So no linkages back to heritage, to traditional culture, to the traditional way of living or of making money. And in the fear of the people moving out of the camp. So the economic opportunities for those people become very, very limited. Once they stay inside the camps, or by staying inside the camps, they do get involved in some commercial type activities, but that's not really enough. It's mostly trading. There's not a lot of value added type activities, so you're not creating a lot of opportunity or economic base for future economic growth. So in what we observed in northern Uganda is that these people, over the recent past, have started moving out, farming smaller plots of land. What we're trying to get them do then is we're still facilitating their continued sort of working back to their original farm plots or homelands or actual home bases. Then there's a whole different ball game in terms of specifically northern Uganda's. You know, it's a very lush part of Africa, and over 25 years, most of what used to be rice upland, rice fields and stuff like that, in 25 years ago, is now basically bush. And so it's a massive job in terms of land clearing. And one of the interventions, for instance, will be to give work to these people through finding ways to clear the land, either manual labor, which they will do, somebody will pay them for, not the project, or to set up businesses where they can actually buy some equipment or lease a tractor and start doing some of that manually. So the approach is to get the IDPs to start moving back to the homelands and establish their residences under the assumption that peace continues. And if peace doesn't continue, well, then it'll be to try and get them to focus on more of a growing type enterprise, growing economic activity outside of the small things that they're already doing inside the camps. Does that fair? Or not?
Sure. Well, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Andrew Cunningham from the Financial Services Volunteer Corps. And my question is about the regulation of commerce and financial transactions. I noticed that Mr. Slavik used the phrase of believe in local capacity, of saying you don't get in the way. And I'm conscious of the example of Albania, which rid itself of communism in 1992, and then there were financial Ponzi schemes which developed, leading to riots and a very difficult situation politically, socially, as well as economically. And Albania and financial markets actually had to start from scratch after I think it was 97. So where do you fit the regulation of financial markets or commercial markets into your model of the value chain and letting commerce bloom?
If in the analysis of the enabling environment shows that there's a lack of regulation, that's an issue impeding activity in the value chain, we can adjust that through an intervention. We do a lot of regulatory and supervisional work throughout the world in terms of building those structures in, you know, Armenia, Macedonia. So it becomes, that's more of a broader constraint that will affect a whole multitude of value chains, and we may not be able to take it on. For instance, in northern Uganda, it's not going to be an issue. Okay, but in other country frameworks, you know, that's where you really have to get, if that's identified as across the board issue, then getting to the powers to be and sort of talking them into doing something about it, usually that requires a bit of government assistance or World Bank assistance to help them put those frameworks in place. In Albania, actually, we were actually called upon. EMG was formerly part of Deloitte, and we actually took apart the Ponzi scheme in Albania and put in the regulatory framework, with the base upon which they built a financial system which seems to be working today, type thing. But I don't understand why that, because, you know, we've had Ponzi schemes in this country and we have excellent financial regulation, or supposedly. So I'm wondering why that, how you made the link.
But it doesn't affect, you can have Ponzi schemes in the U.S., but it doesn't affect, no one calls into question the U.S. financial system. You need to bear Stearns to go bust for that to happen.
Okay.
But in Albania, it seemed to undermine everything that had happened financially in the previous.
One of the things we find over and over and over again is a lack of information. Okay, and information is power. And in the case of Albania, people didn't know they were being taken because there just wasn't any sort of third party or reporting or information network that was out there that they could sort of inform themselves through or with. Next door in Macedonia, just after the state, the privatization of state-owned assets, you know, everybody got a few shares of a company. What happened in Russia, people going around buying up the voting rights of these shares for peanuts and then becoming basically oligarchs. All of them, I think, had their genesis in sort of this approach. We were implementing a project called corporate governance, and we created creation of a shareholder organization association, and got a massive information campaign out there within months of starting to see this, within weeks of this starting to happen, and it stopped. The people actually trying to get power, you know, through the power of the companies, through the buying up of the voting rights, couldn't do it anymore because they were now faced with a person holding a share that knew what the share was worth, knew the power it had, knew the power that he had over that, or that person had over the shares. So all of a sudden, you know, they weren't picking up the voting rights for a cent or 2 cents or a buck. They were having to pay market share for the shares. And stop right then and there. And it had that type of information system been in place in Albania, you know, the pyramid scheme would never have been able to go forth.
Francis Johnson, Strategic Planning Initiatives. Could you tell us a little more about several aspects of your organization's work? One, the source of financing, and do you expect to have continued sources of financing, and might this be from the private sector as well as the public sector? The extent to which indigenous staff are involved in this transformational work, the technical assistance, the outreach, and so on. The could you give us a sense of the impact that your operations in a country may have, the but proportion or fraction of the population that might be affected, realizing that pilot operations are takeoff points, and when you leave, other operations may well copy what you're doing. But we're just interested in hearing further about this amazing initiative that you all are engaged in.
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
I was stressed. EMG is, you know, like I said before, we start off as a part of Deloitte, the sort of the international development consulting arm of Deloitte. What's interesting is our approach to building capacity started back then when our metrics for being an internal part of the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu worldwide network was to build markets for their core services, which is auditing and accounting. And so we went in and we immediately hired local staff because we knew that to be competitive down the road, you need indigenous people to sort of deliver the service and do the types of downstream work. We've always had the belief that you have to work with local people and you have to build their capacity and implicate them from the beginning. And it's becoming more and more so. I think now we're going into countries, certain projects we have where there are no expatriate staff. It's all indigenous staff, okay, which is a huge kudos in terms of we've made a lot of progress. And there's been a lot of supportive activities, educational programs, and you know, people going back after getting a PhD or master's here type thing and getting involved in a local business community or the public sector. Most of our funding comes from donors. We're actually a global organization. We have offices in Australia, London, Brussels, and Washington. And 90% of our funding, 95% of our funding comes from bilateral or multilateral donors for fixed periods of time. Like it's projectized, so we're in and out in the period of 3 to 5 years. An ever-growing part we'd like to see be coming out of the private sector where we can help them move into some of these markets as well type thing. I think that's it. We've been around for about 25, 30 years.
I think we have time for one, maybe two more questions.
Yeah. I appreciate how you put the value chain concept together, because I think that's the thing that I like so much about the Friedman book, which has a lot of controversy, because he really connects the component makers with the big business industries, multinational corporations with all the small companies as well. And so basically his big hope in there is that, you know, that we can create interconnections through commerce and peace. And so I you validated what I also very much believe in. One comment: teaching business has actually, many of my colleagues see that as a seemly type of an discipline. So I constantly have to defend myself because I teach management. I teach good business practices. So and that brings me to what I see happening on a world stage. When you're looking at education globally, many of the people who are doing education are really taking administrative type of education rather than business education. They don't really understand how business works, how you build into relationships. So I think there's a certain amount of colonialism still in developing countries where business is not seen as legitimate. It's seen as corruption. And I think that has to change to have a good peace-building effort.
I think it. You know, everybody's familiar with Africa. It's happening in Africa. I think you're seeing the southern African companies coming north and creating some incredible dynamics that is really helping Africa to grow. It's
what's interesting, I thought we might have gotten to the Kenya issue, because what happened in Kenya was really interesting from both a business and a conflict resolution perspective. It, you know, you had tribal differences that have been laying dormant for 25, 30 years, okay, and all of a sudden pop up because you have what is a very vibrant, Nairobi is a very vibrant growing center, you know, yet one side really had, I don't think they've gotten to the point where they're rich enough yet to they can step off and become honorable to sort of start spreading the wealth, you know. But it's in it that I think as people get some more insight into what happened in Kenya in January and stuff like that, we'll be able to refine some of the things that we've been doing, because you know, some of the power structure, some of the business community was inclusive, and other parts it was not inclusive at all.
Greetings. A question for Center for International Private Enterprise.
Yes.
This first panel, we heard a good deal of how change is triggered, monitored, stimulated by prestigious organizations such as the United Nations commissions or international consultants or travelers who lean on finance ministers to change parts of the Economic Freedom Index and so on. But my acquaintance from afar off of Center for International Private Enterprise, you are practicing some magic at the local level where you are sort of not as a scoutmaster, but a mentor empowering persons who've never been as business outside their own town, perhaps, in discovering that they, under Allah, have a right to identify what are the constraints, what is keeping them down. And furthermore, they had not realized that they could even identify these and speak publicly about them or move into a business association to take their objective opinions and so on and negotiate those desired changes through the power structure. Would you be good enough to tell us a story or elaborate on that part of the process a little bit more?
Specifically, which part of the process?
Bottom-up change-making by
right.
By entrepreneurs who have been excluded or did not know that
absolutely.
They could have a role in setting the rules of the game and causing governors, mayors, and so on over
absolutely.
A period of time to hone to a new line.
Okay. So listening to local voices and listening to the grassroots, I take as a theme here. And I will say at the very beginning of SIFE, back in 1984, SIFE had a mandate to pursue our mission of democracy and free markets. And the question was, well, how do we go about doing this as a new organization? Of course, this is before my time. And back then, just as SIFE had opened its doors, literally the first person to come in to SIFE to talk business was Hernando de Soto. From Peru, and he already had ideas about what needed to be done, about giving people the chance to be entrepreneurs, giving them the institutional rights and freedoms, particularly property rights, that could bring them into the formal economy and give poor people a chance to become entrepreneurs. So he led this grassroots process of advocacy among various informal groups in Peru, street vendors, for example. It's a wonderful story there. I went out in March to look at all these beautiful markets. I thought I was going on an informal sector tour, and we were visiting a bunch of shopping malls where the vendors now have their own title. They have capital financing. They have some kind of license to operate. And they're doing real business, and that's all that they really wanted, as opposed to being seen as a social problem. So, and look at DeSoto today. Now he's at one of these multilateral organizations with the United Nations Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor and spreading those stories through that avenue. But listen to the local ideas and get grassroots input all the time.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the panel for excellent presentations and you for your very insightful questions. This is an ongoing discussion. We're going to have a report sometime in the near future. But if you would like to receive copies of either PowerPoint, I think we could make those available. Please send me or Catherine an email, and we would be more than happy to do so. Thank you very much for coming, and good luck outside. It's well trained.